Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show. A little technical difficulty at the beginning there with queued up music. That's all me in Studio A, Mr. Edwards. So we're just going to go ahead and jump into this program. We have a great program tonight. And over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you doing, sir?
Real good, Mr. Allen. It's kind of unseasonal weather here. I think we all thought we were going to be into the great days of early spring, but this is Minnesota. I understand we have a very significant guest. A man who has actually already been quoted in the New York Times, Minneapolis papers, in fact, was in the Minneapolis Star Tribune's yesterday's edition at a press conference. So he will be giving us some insight into what has been a gripping story in our city since the 15th day of November. So why don't you introduce him, Don, and begin the reflections indicate to how Mr. Wilson how we would like for him to initiate.
Yes, we'd like to welcome a special guest tonight with us on the Ron and Don Show, Mr. Tito Wilson, Northside businessman. I've known him for years. I'm a solid customer, I would say, for myself. And Mr. Tito Wilson, welcome. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, sir. How about yourself?
All right, we're doing great. Well, you know, we're here to talk about the November 15 event, you know, from your perspective. Of course, there are many perspectives. There are many questions out there that people have to this day, and they probably will have probably for the next 3 or 4 months before it turns into a Terrence Franklin-type situation where you don't hear anybody talking about it in our community. But first, I'd like to start off by welcoming you, and I know that can you tell us a little bit about what you do, or tell our listeners? I know it's a rhetorical question, but we want people to know what you do, where you do it at, and how long you've been doing it, and then let's go into the meat and potatoes of what's going on. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, you know, as you know, I own a barber and beauty shop at 2124 and a half West Broadway, Northside, Minneapolis. In my shop, you know, we do the host of services, all types of men, cuts, designs, colors, you know, for the barber side, and then also for the salon side, you know, we offer a whole host of services from, you name it, weaves, sew-ins, colors, again, on that side. You can do a little makeup, you know, retwist dreads, you know, you name it, we pretty much do it there, you know, when it comes to total hair care services.
Okay, well thank you, and, you know, that's a little plug for you on the Ron and Don Show here, probably just as much as it would run on WCCO. But anyway, let's get down to the meat and potatoes of what happened. So what I like to do is I like to back up even before you were outside at the November 15th event, 2015. For our listeners, just to bring you up to speed, as some of you already know, Northside resident Jamar Clark was shot and killed by Minneapolis police. We know that much. What we don't know are the circumstances really clearly, even though we have sworn affidavits, we don't know the circumstances before this all really went down, but can you describe, you know, like let's start maybe 15 minutes before you even got out into the situation of what was going on with you and how you came upon that, and then we'll move into the next section. So go ahead. Let's hear what you have on this for our listeners. This is Tito Wilson. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, well, you know, that particular night, I was just out with some friends. There's a female friend of mine. Her mother had passed, and, you know, they buried her and all on that day. So she wanted to just, you know, come out with some friends, you know, I guess to kind of unwind, you know, have some support or whatever for, you know, have buried her mother. So we initially, we started off down at Red Dragon. You know, I met them late. By the time I got there, they were already pretty much ready to go. So, you know, we left there, and then we went over to the Elks. You know, went in, hung out for a little bit, you know, watched some of the lion dancing, you know, people doing all the these neat dances and stuff like that. So it was probably there maybe about an hour and a half or whatever, you know, before, you know, the Elks, I think it shut down pretty, maybe about 10, 15 minutes before 1 o'clock. So that was what was going on prior to, you know, I coming outside and seeing what was taking place.
Okay, okay, that's great. And so, you know, you're out, you're having a good time with these friends, you know, and that's very admirable of you to hang out with a friend that had such a loss like that. And so you, the Elks is closing, and the Elks is a establishment in North Minneapolis, caters to the community and members, high profile, been there for years.
So we yes. don't get everybody upset at us. It is a fraternal organization.
A fraternal, yes, yes, that's the word I was looking for, Mr. Edwards. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were closing. It was closing time. What quarter to one? 1 o'clock? 2 o'clock?
No.
What'd you say again?
No, quarter to one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
quarter to one.
Okay. It was shutting down.
Okay. Now, if you could walk us through from your affidavits, from what we've read and seen. What happened from the time you hit that sidewalk outside of the club until you made a compelling confirmation that that was Jamar Clark or that you solved this situation? Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, you know, once the lodge was shutting down, myself along with the friends that I was with, one of the persons I was with, she had already left, I think, to go and get her car, whatever. So it was three of us. It was actually four of us all together, but like I said, one had already left, and so three others, and they've all given testimonies also about what they saw that night. So the three of us, we walked outside, and I mean, as soon as we walked outside, we saw what was going on across the street. So I didn't see the part where Jamar was at the paramedic ambulance, you know. And
okay, even before we get to that, Mr. Wilson, even before we get to that, can you describe what was going on across the street? Because that's very important because our listeners, we have about 300 or 400 people in the queue, and I'm getting texts into the studio. Mr. Edwards looking at me going crazy. I'm going crazy watching me. And one of the questions is, okay, you said what was going on across the street, and the listener says, please, Mr. Wilson, can you explain what was going on across the street? Go ahead, sir.
Okay, so what was going on across the street was that the two officers had Jamar on the ground. They had him thoroughly restrained. I saw a body still on the ground, and I saw one officer, had his knee probably in the center part of somewhere, you know, maybe center part of Jamar's body. That was now that we got the whole story, it turns out to be the cop that actually did the shooting, Schwartzy, and the other officer, Riggenberg. He was kind of doing some weird maneuvering, kind of balancing around on the upper part of Jamar's body, probably his upper, mid to upper, like chest, shoulder area. He just kind of bouncing around. And I paid particularly close attention to him because it didn't seem like proper police procedure. So he was bouncing around with his body kind of facing, he was down on kind of like on his butt with his legs pointed across the street at the direction towards us, with Jamar being behind him. And so, you know, he's doing this strange kind of maneuver and bouncing around. And what the only thing I was thinking to myself is, you know, I was saying to myself, I hope this guy is not about to be shot. Because it looked like to me, he was trying to provide cover for the other officer to shoot Jamar. And no sooner I thought, you know, hey, I hope this guy don't get killed, then boom, the shot went off. So I didn't see any kind of scuffling for a gun. I saw a man being thoroughly restrained on the ground. You know, had there been some maneuvering for the gun, I mean, you would have seen, like, legs moving, you know, feet kicking, or something. You know, you're not going to have a lower body abdomen to the lower, you know, body, feet, all that stuff perfectly still, but, you know, the person is struggling for a gun. That man was on the ground under control, thoroughly under control.
So you're saying that from your vantage point and from what you understand about law enforcement procedure, that Clark was on the ground on his stomach, if I'm correct, or on his back? Laying on his stomach or back?
It appeared to me that he was on his stomach, face down. That's
okay.
How it appeared to me. From me looking from, you know, across the street, it looked like to me like he was face down on the pavement.
Okay,
but,
well,
you know, like I said, there was
through
no movement. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. No, okay, but I want you to walk me through this, because I have this vision that is my perception from listening to you, that there are two approximately 200-pound officers, one on the back end of Jamar, and he's docile and secured from your vantage point, and another officer on his upper part of his body, closer to his past his waistline. Would I be correct in assuming that? Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, now.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Now, at some point between those milliseconds of you seeing that, you heard a gunshot. Now, I guess my question to you, and it's a critical question, did you actually see the gunshot, and where was the officer sitting on his lower torso at the time, a millisecond or so after you heard the shot, or a millisecond before you heard the shot, if you can recall?
Well, like I said, all of this kind of bouncing around, or whatever, I paid particularly close attention to that. I could see the other officer. He looked like he was being perfectly still, like he had a good hold on Jamar and was just holding him down, you know, and wherever his hands was, you know what I mean? But it looked like he had perfect control of Jamar's body, along with this other officer that was doing this weird maneuvering. And like
okay.
I said, I
from
paid
the quarter,
really close attention.
Okay, no problem. I don't mean to interrupt you, but we have a lot of questions, and I want to hand it over to Mr. Edwards. But before I do that, I have two more questions. So from the coroner's report, which I finally got through, we understand that the bullet was still in his head. He was shot, and the bullet is stayed inside of his head. There was no exit wound, because if there was an exit wound, I guess the officer sitting on his back would have probably got shot too with that same bullet. So what you're telling us tonight here on the Ron and Don Show is that you heard a shot milliseconds after you saw these two officers have this guy restrained down on the ground. My next question is, was he handcuffed?
Okay. I could not determine whether or not Jamar Clark was handcuffed. I can't give a definitive answer on that. But what I will say beyond that is it really doesn't matter. And you know, from my perspective, me being a civilian, you know, a citizen of the city of North Minneapolis, it doesn't matter to me whether he was handcuffed or not. And the reason why I say so is because he was thoroughly restrained. And if I can't go further,
yes.
To me, so if you have a man restrained on the ground, and let's just take a part of the officer's story, and let's just say Jamar was maneuvering for a gun or reaching for a gun. From my thinking is, okay, you have a man on the ground. It's two of you guys. Why is it the first thing that you can think of, or the first thing that you want to do, is take out a gun and put it to his head? If you have this man on the ground, even if he was squirming, even if he was fighting, which I didn't see, and I say he was not, but even if he was, why not take mace and spray it in his eye? Why not take a taser and tase him to subdue him and get him under control if all of that was going on?
And I would like to attempt to give you an answer to that. Now, police officers, for the most part, are trained to eliminate any threat that they perceive. It's unlike the former military, And in the military, you know, if someone's trying to kill you, of course you kill them. If there's someone there that you might need information from, because obviously even before you got to the point where you saw Mr. Clark on the ground restrained by the two police officers, there was an incident between a female and Mr. Clark, according to the first statements or the statements sworn affidavits. So there's a difference there, and I can agree with you that maybe in some cases there should be some discretion. Like one of our callers said last week regarding this situation, 60-something seconds is like 5 minutes when you're in that kind of situation. In the battlefield, you know, people, you know, 1 second could be like 10 minutes, you know, not to exaggerate too much, but
yeah,
there's a lot of derivatives and variables.
But,
go ahead.
But Don.
Yes. I'm going to say.
The deal is you have a man that has not presented a weapon at all, a gun, a knife, not even some freaking rat poison, nothing. He's presented no weapon. And from the videos that the district attorney or county attorney, whatever he is, whatever he put out, I mean the video they put out, you saw a man standing there with his hands in his pocket. There's no audio, so we don't know what we're saying. But when a person's upset or aggressive, you're going to see more than just a person standing there with their hands in their pocket. You know, you may see a person wild, person moving around, or maybe getting in a fighting pose or whatever. So the deal is, I can hear the, you know, 60 seconds may seem like an eternity or whatever, but you don't have a man that's putting up a fight. There is no way in the world that they could really, truly expect to give this story to the community that Jamar was so much of a threat that, you know, and they didn't say that he had the gun in his hand and maybe putting it to one of the cops' head. They said he's reaching for the gun, had his hand on the gun. There's some DNA on the gun. And also they said that those cops were so afraid for their life that they thought that he was going to be able to take the gun away from Riggenberg, shoot him, and then turn and shoot the other cop, and possibly be a threat to other people in the community. I mean, come on, man. That is the most ridiculous story I've ever heard.
Okay, well,
it's absolutely
ridiculous.
If you hold on, one more thing, if you can, please, one more thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, how in the world is this guy so much of a – you got the Schwartzy guy, you know, now put with the statement come out saying that he had his gun to the corner of Jamar's mouth. And you want to tell me you're still afraid for your life? Jamar doesn't have the gun. He hasn't shot Riggenberg. But you're still so afraid for your life, you got a gun to the corner of his mouth, and he's going to scream out, go ahead, you know, I'm ready to die? I mean, come on, man. The story that they put out is shameful, and they should be ashamed of themselves for putting that story out.
I would like to bring Mr. Edwards in because he has some analysis and questions that he would like to ask also. And Mr. Edwards, please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Allen. Again, Mr. Wilson, thank you for being on the program. This is a program that is both international and domestic, so there are a lot of people listening and et cetera. I want to ask a couple of specific questions based on the narrative that you gave us in your opening comments. Let us start like this. Number one, have you given a Q&A to the authorities, and if so, do you remember the date and the location?
I spoke with the FBI and the BCA on it was Tuesday or Wednesday. It was 2 or 3 days later. I think it was on that Wednesday following.
The 18th of November, does that sound familiar?
It would have had to been on Wednesday, yes. So that would have been, if Sunday was the 15th, then yeah,
okay.
Wednesday's 18th.
Now, I don't want us to be accused of in any way compromising your situation, so I'm going to ask you a series of questions like this. You gave a what is called a Q&A, a question and answer. There were two agents there, right, that interviewed
absolutely.
You. Is that correct? Is
absolutely.
That
absolutely.
Coincide with your recollection of the day that you gave the statement?
Absolutely.
Okay. And let's say you gave the statement around 10 o'clock a.m. in the morning at the FBI headquarters. Is that, does that coincide with your recollection?
Somewhere around there. You know,
okay.
I went to the FBI building around 10, maybe a few minutes after. So mm-hmm. in between like 10 and 11 or whatever. But yeah.
Well, let's cut it down a little bit more because as you, I assume already know, you will be summoned before a federal grand jury. As a part of the federal investigation. So, and that option is not one that is debatable because the federal authorities under federal law are required in pursuing a matter such as this to take it before a grand jury. So there won't be any demands that it not go before a grand jury and et cetera. The U.S. attorney does not have that option. So let's say that the time was approximately 10:12. Do you remember how long you gave it took you to give a statement? Do you kind of remember?
Roughly, I think I was in their offices roughly 30 to 45 minutes.
Okay. Would 25 minutes seem to be closer?
Well, you know, it could be. It could
okay.
be. I was in there for
right.
I wasn't keeping track of the time. I
okay,
was in there
I got you. I understand.
You know, I think I see where you're trying to take this to. I think
well,
I see
not,
where you're
it's not a
to
question
go.
Of trying to take it. It's a question of the evidence, the material evidence and the testimony. So let me, if I could, continue. So you give a statement. By the way, did you review your statement, and did you sign it and initial it?
Can we?
Do you
ask
remember?
Ask me questions. You know, can we focus on what happened that night? I mean, because the things that you're asking me, I believe you probably have all of that information. So if we can talk about what happened that night, that's what I'm concerned about. You know,
well, what I'm concerned about
if
is
I
that
want to speak to
the reason I'm asking the
jury.
Questions is that, you know, I'd hate to see you in any way misstate on this program what it was that you provided to the authority. That's what I'm
okay.
attempting
well,
to do.
But, right, but if you're asking
yeah.
me about what
yeah.
I
okay,
talked
well,
to
let's
about,
do it like you want to do it,
let's
Mr.
talk
Wilson.
About that.
Yeah,
hold,
let's
hold
do it
on.
Like
you
want
said
to
you
do
wouldn't
it.
Offer
okay.
you wouldn't
yeah,
offer
well,
me
well,
well,
we'll do that.
But if
all right,
talking
so
about
you
talking
you
about
indicated
the,
well, let's do this because we shouldn't talk over each other. So and we were respectful of you getting us the narrative. So you were in the Elks. One of your party went to pick to get a car to come back. You came up the stairs. You came out the door. Did you hear the shot as you came out the door, or did you see the shot?
No, absolutely not. I did not. When we got outside, we watched what was going on for roughly about a minute, and then the shot went off. So I was
for
outside.
A minute,
I
and then the shot
outside.
Went off.
I
saw okay.
For about a minute. For about a minute, we was outside watching what was taking place with Jamar and the police, and then the shot went off.
Okay.
So I was
did you ever,
outside.
Did you ever go back into the club?
Absolutely, I did.
And did you then come back again? Do you
we
remember?
We went back, and when the shot went off, everybody kind of got alarmed. I walked back inside, stayed inside for a little bit, then tried to come back outside, and we saw the streets were full of cops,
mm-hmm.
of cops at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we went back in again. We stayed mm-hmm. in for a few minutes, maybe about three minutes or whatever, and then we left. We went ahead and just got out of the club.
Yeah, okay.
Or the lodge, whatever they call it.
So you were out, in, out, and out, okay. And now you're saying that about a minute after coming through the door upstairs from the Elks the first time, that's when you heard the shot. That's correct. And you saw the officers engaged with Mr. Clark. Okay. And that, I mean, I have to ask you again, Ms. Wilson. So that was your testimony to the agents at around 10:12 a.m. on the 18th at the FBI headquarters. Is that correct? I mean, is that what we're saying?
You got mm-hmm. the records, bro.
Well, that's what good journalism is about, bro. Mm-hmm. So, your your statement and position is that you saw the struggle. Did you hear Mr. Clark cry out, "I want to die"?
Absolutely not, because it wasn't said. If he said that, he must have whispered it.
Okay, all right. And were you asked any questions about did you hear anything?
I probably was.
Okay.
I'm sure I was asked about that.
Do you remember your response?
Like I'm telling you now, and if you have the record, you can say, I did not hear any going on between Jamar Clark in terms of them talking to each other, I'm ready to die, or this Riggenberg, you know, saying he has my gun, you know, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him. I didn't hear any of that. I'm sure if I was asked that question on that day, I give the same answer that I'm giving now. I didn't hear any of that. And
okay.
if they were saying it, they were whispering to each other.
Now, were you able to tell the investigators on the occasion of your Q&A which of the two officers you saw fire their weapon?
Absolutely not. I told them I couldn't really tell. I said, I believe it probably had to have been the guy that was on his back because of the maneuvering of the Riggenberg, the guy that was facing us. I couldn't tell. And I also told him, which you probably have record of, that it could have been that he had, you know, put one hand behind his back and pulled the trigger, but I believe it probably was the other cop that did the shooting. But I could not clearly see which cop did it, but because of the maneuvering of Riggenberg, I did not believe that he was the one did it. But I was not 100% sure about that.
Okay, all right. And you've already certainly indicated your own personal thoughts and reflections on the death of Mr. Clark and what was happening. I want to go back just a tad, because you said that, in fact, initially, didn't you use the word that he was in compliance?
I probably used a lot of words, you know.
No, I'm just asking you your recollection of what it was that you stated, sir. That's all. I mean, did you feel that he was in compliance? Or that he was not resisting?
I certainly felt like he was not resisting.
Okay.
He was not. He was not resisting. If I use the word compliance, whether I use pinned down or under control, I'm sure I used a myriad of words, you know, to describe what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And this is on the occasion of your statement. Right. Yeah, we'd be poor journalists if, in fact, we did not ask you questions commensurate with your statement. Because, as I think you already know, Mr. Wilson, you're going to be brought before a federal grand jury. Prosecutor is going to bring you in. You will not be able and allowed to have any counsel or et cetera. They're going to ask you these questions, and this will go a long ways towards determining if there will be some semblance of justice for Jamar Clark, you know, because clearly some of this inconsistency was what the county attorney made reference to. Made the determination that he made. That's our responsibility here to at least ask a series of questions based on.
Can I say something here?
Why, certainly.
You say something about inconsistency. When you have a situation where, you know, a man is being, you know, subdued by a cop, you're going to have people, witnesses, is going to be, from their vantage point, they're going to see different things. One witness may be closer, so they may see something that I did not see. Or they may be on the left side, I'm on the right side, so we're going to see things that the other did not see. But one thing that is thoroughly consistent with all of our statements is that he was not resisting arrest. There's nowhere in any of those statements that say that Jamar Clark was resisting arrest and he was fighting for a gun. So, of course, from different people's vantage points, they're going to see different things. That does not mean that the witnesses are not credible. That doesn't mean that they're telling a lie. It just means from where their angle allowed for them to see, they saw what they saw. So, deal is, we have our story. All of us say that he was not fighting for a gun. The cops have their story. That's the narrative that Mike Freeman put out. That's the Freeman. I mean, that's the story that he went with.
Yeah, I clearly understand, and we look forward to your testimony before a federal grand jury and how the U.S. attorney will report that out. I know that's clearly where we're at. And, you know, as you said, there are different people that have different versions. By the way, if I could ask, how far did you feel you were in proximity to the struggle that was going on? 30, 40 feet, 25 feet? How close do you think you were?
Well, you know what? That was a question that the one of the persons that interviewed me asked. I don't know how big, how wide Plymouth Avenue is. I don't know. So if I can go out there with a tape measure and call you back, I'll do that.
Well, let me do this because I'm not trying to be cute with you or anything like that. I mean, I can understand a little tension. But let me ask you the question, sir. Did they ever ask you to participate in a reenactment of what it was that you saw going on?
Participate in a reenactment?
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
You go back to the scene
of
the crime, and you do kind of a reenactment.
No,
you talk in terms
absolutely
of
not.
What you saw,
no.
Where you saw it, where you were standing, things like that. That's what reenactment means.
Oh, I get that. I get that. But no,
okay.
I was never asked to come and do a reenactment. But I did as best as I could while I was in there.
Yes, I understand, sir.
To demonstrate what I saw that night.
Yes. All right. Well, Mr. Allen, I've asked a series of questions that I would want to ask based on the Q&A that, by the way, is now a public document. So thank you, Mr. Wilson.
I like to interject something too, and something that Mr. Edwards said, you know, regarding the inconsistencies. And I don't think Tito, Mr. Wilson, that was exactly pointed to you. It's just in concern with the alleged female victim in this whole case, and the change of story or a different story or different narrative, and people are concerned. There are possibly community members that might have another version of that relationship, which might be disheartening for the whole community. But we do have a couple callers here that have been holding for about 11 minutes, and I'd like to get the first one on. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead. What's your name and what's your question? And can you turn your computer down or radio?
Yeah, is it me or somebody else?
That is you. That is you, sir.
Yeah, okay. No,
yes,
I'm
sir.
Just wondering, too. How do you think this 10-year-old's testimony will be taken, being that was the first thing we kind of all saw, and he sounded very credible, even though he's only 10 years old? I mean, so I'm just wondering how that's going to be looked at, or how did they look at it?
You know, that's difficult to say because no one asked that question of the county attorney. That's a question that should have been asked by leadership who were in the room, in the grand jury room. I thought it was kind of ironic that Mike Freeman, after indicating that he was going to support the demands of the community about no grand jury, would hold the public briefing in the grand jury room there in the county. But to your specific question about the 10-year-old, no one asked Mr. Freeman that question at what happened with the testimony of the 10-year-old. That may be a good question, sir, that many of you in community may want to ask. I've been rather puzzled on why we haven't heard any more about the 10-year-old. I do know that there was a lot of interviewing and dissecting of what he said. But, you know, that may be a doggone good question for the NAACP and Black Lives Matter to ask. And, by the way, if the 10-year-old was interviewed, his statement should be in the 1,200 pages of interviews that is now part of the public record. That is a doggone good question.
All right. Can I say one last thing?
No. Mr. Allen, let the caller stay with us. Let the caller stay with us. If he has a couple questions, no problem. We're going an hour and a half.
Yeah, I've crisscrossed this country, been all over the Midwest, and I know there's been incidents like this that have happened all over the country, obviously. And I got relatives 80 on down who have witnessed various things, and they know this stuff happens all the time. We all know this. This is not too far-fetched. And I just think it's very simple, and I know you got to prove it, but I just think the cop got pissed because he said F you, and he shot him. I don't know why that's so complex. Of course, we got to prove it, but I think that's exactly what happened. He got pissed. I mean, they probably were incensed that he was messing with the paramedics. Okay, we all would be taken aback by that. But then after he said F you, the cop got pissed. He's a young white cop, and he just shot him. Thought he could get away with it. I don't know why that's so complex for some people.
Yeah.
Can I say something?
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank
appreciate you calling in. Okay.
Yep. All right. Yep.
Next caller, Mr. Allen. We have the call.
Okay.
The lines are open.
Yep.
But by the way, is Mr. Wilson still with us? Because we don't want to keep him hanging.
Yes,
okay.
He,
all right.
He, Yeah, he has a comment, but we have someone calling from Atlanta. Go ahead. You're live on the air. Your name and what's your question?
Yeah. I have a good evening, gentlemen. I'm just listening, so I'm trying to get caught up on everything.
All right.
Oh,
thank
okay.
you, sir,
well, thank
and
you.
Continue
thank
to listen from Atlanta. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr.
Wilson,
Allen, if Mr. Wilson has a question or a comment.
Go ahead, Mr. Wilson. You have something to say?
You know, in terms of that 10-year-old boy statement, we don't know what's going to happen with it. But I would say probably not much, because the deal is, I think all of our statements pretty much have been discredited. You know what I mean? And the officer's statements are the ones that were taken into account, and it seemingly is what Mike Freeman went on solely. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with that little boy's account. But I would hope
okay.
it would be considered serious and credible, you know, not just because he's a young kid and happens to live in that area code that means that he's not credible. And I'm gonna tell you one other thing, then I'm gonna be quiet. The reason why I decided to speak out about this is because I saw an injustice, and I know many times when you have African Americans that may have a record, you know, they may be a felon or maybe have DUIs or whatever their challenges may have been, you know, they're not credible because they have all these things in this background. I personally don't have, not, I've never, I'm not an angel. I've, you know, have some whatever in, you know, my long ago past, but I don't have all of these challenges. So I put forth, you know, what I saw because I'm not a felon. You know, a lot of people ask me, well, you know, why did you say something or whatever? But I know most of the time they discredit African-American testimony just because of mainly where they live and maybe if they have some type of, you know, challenges on their criminal record from the past.
Okay. Appreciate it, Mr. Wilson. I think that's an in-depth analysis. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah,
Allen.
I appreciate it.
I'm going to stay on the line for a while if you guys
don't mind. Oh, great. We love having you with us. Go right ahead. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
By the way, if there's any
questions specifically for Mr. Wilson, as long as he's on with us, we certainly want to allow him to respond.
Yes, and the number here is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. You're listening to the Ron and Don Show. In closing this out and moving on to some other stuff, but maybe kind of reflecting on this, Mr. Wilson, you know, I posted on Facebook that we were going to be looking at some other things in the show. I know that there was a big doo-ha-ha on all the radio stations, the mainstream radio stations, about the alleged female involved in this incident. I just want people to know that she's definitely a victim. Her ankle was hurt. She was in back of an ambulance, and we are not going after her in the least bit. But there is a story there, a narrative that needs to come out in the community so that we can be clear on what actually put Mr. Clark and that situation in kind of this deadly confrontation with the police, because there is another story. Unfortunately, we're not able to get that or hear that, but we're hearing the after effects. And that's just something that people are going to have to deal with in their conscience. But with that said, Mr. Edwards, again, we'd like to thank Mr. Wilson for being on. And I'm going to put you in the queue, and if someone calls and has a specific question for you, I will click back on and get you live on the air. But you'll be there with us, okay?
Okay. Yep. Let me do this. Mr. Allen,
okay.
Unless we have someone who has already been holding, last week we had a couple people that were holding, and we were kind of impolite and had them holding far beyond the time that they should. But if we do not have anyone holding, I want to put this question out to the community, because the statements that have been given over a almost 5-month period are now part of the public record, as facilitated by our good friend, the county attorney. Let me ask this question. People now are basically confirming, based on our Freeman narrative, if you will, there's a letter in the EDOP page of the Minneapolis Star Tribune by Stephen Belton of the Urban League. everyone now kind of admits, and in fact, Mr. Wilson touched on it. He indicated that about a minute after he had come out the door. That was his statement just now. And, of course, by the way, our programs are what are called on demand. So each and every program we've ever done can be called up. Now, how was it, Mr. Allen, and this is for a communitarian caller that wants to call in, how was it that the police, upon their arrival, the time that they pulled up, the time they got out, the time they walked towards the ambulance, and Mr. Clark, who was it that would have briefed them on any situation pertaining to what kind of danger that Mr. Clark may have represented? We've not heard a narrative on that. Now, I guess, should we believe that the officers just saw this black man standing there and it was a combination of his hands in his pockets and et cetera? Or were they told something by a person that they would respect, if you will? Doesn't necessarily mean we would necessarily respect him, but that they would respect a person in authority and et cetera. I just want to see if any of our callers and any of our listeners have analyzed and thought about what was it that was told the officers upon their arrival. Okay? That's the question we throw out there now at this particular point, Mr. Allen. Now, at some point, if we don't get a response, let's say in the next 7 or 8 minutes, I will then take the opportunity to detail a significant piece that was clearly omitted by the county attorney and by the White Fourth Estate. But if we have a caller, Mr. Allen, let's get him in. Mr. Allen must be on the phone with another caller.
I am
caller.
Back, Mr. Ayres. I apologize. I am back.
Sure, sure.
And, I was just getting some text messages and asking those people to call into the show because they weren't aware that we were on. I don't know why we're on every Wednesday, but hopefully they will call in. They have not as yet. But
I see. Okay. Well, we put the question out there.
Yes,
who was
it
that briefed the officers upon their arrival that there was a imminent and clear danger and presence of danger? See, no one talked about that. And our good friend, again, the county attorney, did not give us that as a part of the narrative, okay?
No, he did not. And that's nowhere in the paperwork that I read online. I printed up, wasted a lot of ink.
There is a statement in the 1,200 pages.
Okay.
People just kind of got to take time and do a little homework. There is a statement within the 1,200 pages that maybe folks may want to analyze that had a lot to do with, you know, positioning the police and giving them what we call the prima facie to confront Mr. Clark and to take him down with what people are saying is an illegal hold. It is in the documents. Let me also say this, Mr. Allen, to keep things moving, because this is an issue that must be talked about and et cetera. There were, and Mr. the county attorney really wasn't, you know, as up front with the NAACP and those organizations. I mean, organizations headed by law professors and professors and et cetera. We also are awaiting the final report from the investigative committee of the NAACP. You remember that was on our program. And, of course, if anyone, you know, wants to challenge that, we will reach into On Demand and play that portion of a program 3 weeks ago. But I'm just wondering at what point we will be made aware that there were 50 additional statements, Mr. Allen, that
That's
the
right,
county
yep.
attorney never made reference to, but that he absolutely utilized as an instrument to reach his decision. I repeat that again. There are 50 statements that he utilized, because what Mr. Wilson said as he was departing us, if you will, is that there apparently was no significant importance and meaning to the, I understand, what, 20 African-Americans or thereabouts who I assume gave statements and whose statements are contained in the 1,200-page document. So I want to throw that out as well as the question that we previously threw out. Who was it and how were the police officers briefed as it pertains to possible illegal actions by Mr. Clark before that 61-second episode which led to Mr. Clark being shot and killed? So that's
caller,
out there. Phone lines are open. Give that number
again,
Mr. Allen. We're looking to hear how our community is thinking.
at 347-426-3904, and we have a caller, a friend of the
All
show.
All right, let's get the
Go
caller.
Go ahead, sir. You're
Gentlemen,
live on the
am
air.
Am I joining? Thank you.
Yes,
am I
yes.
I'm joining the conversation now?
Yes, and
yes, you are.
Thank you. Welcome. And your observation, sir.
Well, I guess in addressing your, you know, listening to your program, obviously you gentlemen are giving us, you know, such a wealth of information that for some reason we don't get by the plethora of media that we have in this city. It takes two gentlemen such as yourself to really make a strong attempt to, you know, address this serious issue. I don't know. I guess the two officers, you know, they must have received some type of, a dispatch. Isn't that how it usually works? You know, you get a dispatch that there's trouble or there's something at a situation, and then they were called to that particular scene at that particular time.
That's pretty good, fairly close, except when the 911 call went out from the ambulance. They were in the station house. They had already been in the station house and made a stop through. They jumped in their SUV and navigated the actually 3.5 blocks to the scene where the ambulance was at and where the confrontation, some say, was about to take place. Let me just cut to the chase, Em, and kind of get your feelings. See, the person that briefed them upon their arrival and as they got out of the SUV and et cetera, see, everybody is kind of played by him, though, during the press conference. The county attorney, our good friend Mike Freeman, went to great lengths to talk in terms of all the positive people, and of course, this person was one of the positive people, along with the police officers. Was the supervisor, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, of the EMT unit, who had also arrived on the scene prior to the police. He is the individual that briefed them that they were looking at a dangerous and out-of-control suspect. And I just don't think that our good friend, the county attorney, spent a lot of time educating us on what it was that the EMT supervisor, not to be confused with the two paramedics who were attending to the African-American woman in the ambulance with the doors closed. So I'm just laying that out and just kind of getting your thoughts on that, Kim, and anybody else who wants to call in.
You know, my next question to that would be at that appointed hour, you know, what would compel a supervisor to come onto that scene?
Supervisor heard the 911 signal from the ambulance and was in the vicinity. It just happened to be, though, we could have stood a little better narrative. You've asked a heck of a question. I mean, what was it that had the supervisor in the area at approximately 12:30? Actually 12:35, because there is a timeline on when he arrived, and he was briefed by his personnel on what the situation was and the identification of an African-American, you know, standing outside of the ambulance, if you will, more down towards the apartment. And so we never really heard, I repeat again, during the press conference, and of course our leadership who was there and who are attorneys, law professors, and et cetera, never asked that question of Mr. Freeman, and I noticed that question has not been asked by the White Fourth Estate, and I just have a feeling it probably will not be asked, though it may be asked of the EMT supervisor when he makes his appearance before the federal grand jury. But because it is quote unquote in closed session, we may never know.
Boy, that statement still to me. You know, Mr. Edwards says to me, you know, what warranted such a heightened response to a situation where, okay, you already had ambulance people there. You already, you know, now the police are coming, now the supervisor's coming, but you have one person there, Mr. Clark, and all of these people are racing to the scene. Now, that's just in this scenario, okay, in this scenario that we're talking about now. All these people are racing to the scene. But then out of the narrative from the county attorney, you know, the officers were in fear of this individual. So this
there,
heightened
there
response.
There you are, M, and to our listening audience domestically and internationally, what was it that was told to these officers? Because the call that they would get was from the 911 dispatcher who had talked to a person who said mm-hmm. not that there was a imminent threat, but that they had been injured, right? Right. And so they needed attention, and there had been a small altercation, but you know, nothing that would appear by the nature of law to have alerted the police that there was a clear and present danger. Now, so somebody had to be responsible for, first of all, providing the information to the EMT supervisor, who then relayed that information to the officers. Well, it would appear, gentlemen and ladies, that the only person that could have done that, or persons, in this case it would be persons, were the two medical attendants, the two EMTs, who were assisting a victim of a domestic situation. And that person, those two people, would have had to be the people that would have made their supervisor aware of what the current state of affairs were, and consequently, I use the word for the eighth time, a clear and present danger. Again, I would encourage people to take a look at the 1,200 pages that are quote-unquote a part of the county attorney's public, so-called public narrative, because those statements are a part of the statements of 50 law enforcement and first responders.
Wow. So
M, you're right on point, M. That was something that just hasn't been shared with us colored people.
So, Mr.
Yeah,
Edwards,
I mean,
no, go ahead, M. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well,
M.
No, again, with the number of people on the scene, including two armed, trained officers, as your EMTs, and one unarmed young man. And again, some of these things were actually pointed out in a very eloquent op-ed piece in the Star Tribune by a young lady a few days ago. I don't know if you recall that.
Oh, I don't recall her name. We've been capturing all of the information. Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But she really laid it, you know, on the line from the standpoint of, you know, these are questions that any thinking, rational person would have based on the events and based on the information that we've been given based on the elaborate press conference that was given by our county attorney, which seemed to explain a scene and scenario that we didn't see. I mean,
yes, sir.
His interpretation, it was like watching some of the old, you know, foreign films when you'd see people move and talk and they'd have words come up and the words don't go along with the picture. I mean, that's what that came across as to me. Very elaborate. This happened. We know this. We see the officer. We see grabbing the pistol. None of that was seen on those videos as he explained it. So, again, the intrigue, I think, is really heightened. And I really, you know, like how you honed in on a particular question, a particular scenario that really we have not got an answer to. I mean, it was not addressed. From what I heard in the press conference, was not addressed, and I viewed the tapes, I viewed the videos, I viewed everything, at least all the things that they have revealed online. I reviewed those, and the trail leads me nowhere.
Absolutely. And let me also take the opportunity now, we're into the last, 35 minutes of tonight's program. Let me suggest that folks may want to take a look at the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, which will be out would hit the streets today. And I encourage people to take a look at what happened to a man by the name of Jerome Copeland, who was a clear and concise witness to what happened. And also, you know, they are welcome to review his Q&A, which has mysteriously emerged. It disappeared at one time. In fact, we reflected on that even last week, M, as you remember, and to our other listeners and readers. Mr. Copeland was jailed for 3 weeks because of information he gave to the investigators which correlated with information that they ultimately came into possession of, and which caused them to confirm that that information was accurate for Mr. Copeland, and that Mr. Copeland, quote-unquote, was a person of danger, if you will. And let me close it like this, because we don't want to have people, you know, trying to figure out how complex this was, but we would encourage them to read Mr. Copeland's statement and to read our article in this week's Spokesman Recorder. But one of the things, gentlemen, and Em, I think you would have a great appreciation of this because of your work history, if you will. It was ironic that the legal entity that attempted to prosecute Mr. Copeland and send him back to the penitentiary over a issue in which he had walked away from the halfway house and treatment center that he was in because of racism. It was Mr. Allen, Mr. M, it was the county attorney who moved to imprison Mr. Copeland and knew the full facts of the reason that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension specifically, and then later Mr. Copeland's probation officer, had made a decision to lie about the reasons for in revoking the conditions of his probation and imprison him. It was not until the Hennepin County District Judge, after hearing, and this is a rare situation, what I'm about to say, that his attorney fought for him with great passion and convinced the district court that he was being wrongly held, being adjudicated to have his probation revoked, and ordered him released, and he is now walalking the streets of our city. And his his Q&A was just discovered in the last 24 hours. Okay? We now exclusively bring you that information from the Ron and Don program. Any reflections, Em, and any specific questions of me, who was present when Mr. Copeland gave his statement to the authorities?
I guess the only follow-up I can really have to that scenario and that sequence of events is I know that they're, at least, you know, they're alluding to an overriding type of federal investigation that will go on to kind of oversee and hopefully review these, Keystone Cop type things that we've seen now. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering during that process if, you know, Mr. Copeland will be, you know, asked to give his statement again.
I'm authorized to share this. Mr. Copeland was contacted last Friday by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and have indicated to him that he is a person of significant interest and that he will be subpoenaed to give testimony before a federal grand jury. Now, what's going to be real, real ticklish politically for our political institutions is that there's going to be real difficulty when they talk in terms of the presentation made by Mr. Copeland's attorney, which allowed Mr. Copeland to be freed from 3 weeks of imprisonment in the Hennepin County workhouse, and who it was that attempted revoke the conditions and terms and conditions of his probation. I just don't think that the system, and I don't think that the White Fourth Estate has the intestinal fortitude to really follow that story. But the African American Fourth Estate has certainly put it out there. How people deal with it, it's up to them.
Okay. Stand by, Em. We have another caller, Mr. Edwards. Stand by.
Let's go.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Mr. Nelson, how are you doing, sir? NAACP member, I assume. I must indicate right off the bat, because we've been kind of waiting for an NAACP member to indicate what was the decisions of the branch at its meeting last night here in Minneapolis with regards to the decision by the county attorney. Can you share it with us?
Well, there was no mention of that at last night's meeting, and that primarily is because Madam President didn't bother to show up to last night's meeting.
I'm sorry. You said the president of the NAACP was not at the first branch meeting since the determination by the county attorney?
Absolutely. She was not. And she was not present, and I thought that, you know, because I was a little late myself, so I had asked had she shown up and left. But, no, she did not bother to show up, so there was no mention of what is going on since the county attorney came down with his decision. There was a lot of praising of the president and her glorious work she's done, but, no, she was a no-show.
Okay, so was the membership that was in attendance last night at the branch meeting of the NAACP of Minneapolis, were they briefed on the strategies to ask the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota and then the governor and then the U.S. Attorney to reopen the investigation? Of course, you don't need to ask the U.S. Attorney because his division of government are actively preparing additional interviews and issuing subpoenas for folks to appear before a sitting grand jury. But so did the branch have any kind of discussion on what the strategy is going to be on that?
No, we did not. Again, there was a lot of praising of the job that the president had did up until the point of that she got the county attorney to produce no grand jury and to come with a decision that backfired in her face.
Let me ask this question, Mr. Nelson, who was an NAACP member of good standing. Was there any discussion as it pertains to what was the logic in expecting that this county attorney, given his history, would have done anything different than what he did? Did you folks have any discussion along those lines?
At the risk of sounding like a broken record, Mr. Edwards, we did not. There was not a discussion of that. There was no mention of that. It may have happened, you know, again, could have happened before I had arrived, but while I was in attendance, that was not mentioned. Again, I'm not trying to be facetious, but there was just simply a lot of praising of what the president had done up until this point, and they were a lot of patting on the back of what had been accomplished. And so the real question is,
I would ask him and my colleague, Mr. Allen, I mean, could you just kind of share with us what has been accomplished? I mean, I know that the groups were, you know, kind of rolling with the emotions now gripping our city. We're over at the state legislature with a series of economic proposals to fund them, if you will. Is that to maintain a clearer path to African-American wealth and economic uplifting, or is that just to conduct business as usual?
Are you asking any of us, Mr. Edwards?
Yes, I mean, anybody's free. It's free.
Okay, I'm specifically kind of picking on
Mr. Nelson. I know it's unfair, but Mr. Nelson is an active member of the NAACP of Minneapolis. And we have you know, battered him on occasions over the last couple of months about what the heck is happening. I mean, it was he that drew out the information that a secret committee. In fact, we remember we were given a telephone number, Mr. Allen, over the air, that if we called that phone number, we would be properly educated about what that powerful committee was going to do. And that was one of the reasons. That's where I was kind of going with Mr. Nelson. Was that I would have assumed that yesterday, last night, that committee would have reported to the general membership, but apparently it didn't. So now I ask the question, has there been any explanation on why there was such significant confidence? Because, I mean, gentlemen and ladies, I mean, just 3 weeks ago, we were being told that there was a tremendous amount of confidence in the sitting county attorney, Mr. Mike Freeman. So, Mr. Nelson, I just have to pick on you, and if him or Mr. Allen wanted to tie in, I mean, what was it that caused that confidence to be lost, you know, after he made the determination?
And this is Don. I don't know what's happening with that, Mr. Edwards, because I have yet to go to a regular NAACP meeting, although I am a member with in good standing with three membership cards. And
yeah,
and I don't think the determination was there, but I am actually I wish our live chat could be captured. I'm not on my Mac. I'm on another computer. I'll also take a screenshot, but I just had someone to ask me, you know, what I think the situation with Jamar Clark and the young lady was. And this person kind of, he said, think domestic. So whenever there's a confrontation, not to go off topic, but whenever there's a confrontation between a man and a woman, the tag that law enforcement uses is domestic.
Yeah.
So then we are led to believe that these two people are in a home or in a house or near a domicile, and they are connected in some way. But let's look at this, let's stand back and look at this from another perspective. Mr. Edwards, you had talked about the super being there on the site, allegedly or probably briefing the police about an alleged threat, which would have been Mr. Clark, our feared person, Mr. Clark. Why would have that been the situation? Was there a drug deal gone bad? Did someone owe another person some money and some tension went down? And I'm just speculating because I have people hitting me with information that, you know, I want to put out there and be fair, because everything's fair at this point, and we have to find out what went on. Of course, for a black man to be shot unarmed is wrong. I agree with that 100%. But again, like I said about 12 minutes ago, there is another piece of this that we're not getting. And, wow, the phone lines are lighting up, Mr. Edwards, but I would like to
We still have M with us. M, any reflections at this point?
Well, I mean, I guess that was quite a statement by Mr. Allen. And I think especially with the fact of the alleged girlfriend, whatever status she was, coming out well after the fact, and apparently she had given some statements, or at least some statements were reported that she had given to the police. And there was a period of time where those statements were the only statements we heard.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
Then, after a period of time, after all those statements that repeated what she apparently had said or what had gone on that night, then she comes out and pretty much turns the tables on all of those statements. So again, the time, you know, why all this time going by before coming out? I think that hurts, you know, some of the statements that were made. I mean, she was there. So, I mean, you kind of have to reflect on what she did have to say, because she was there, and hearing from someone that was actually there on the scene. We haven't heard from any of the EMTs. They were there. We haven't heard from them.
Well, let me just correct you, though. I mean, yes, we have, because as I pointed out earlier, all of their statements are in the 1,200-page document, and all of their statements are categorized and captured under first responders and law enforcement. Let me just say this, Em. See, what we're beginning to get into now is the question that I pose. That does not make me omnipotent or et cetera. But what was it that the EMT supervisor was told that he felt so comfortable, or what was it he heard that he felt so comfortable upon giving a quick briefing to the two police officers upon their arrival? Because he, prior to their arrival, was inside of the ambulance and heard conversation between those three parties. So that now puts four people in the ambulance who are discussing the reasons for the condition of the African-American woman, who for months many of us thought was the, you know, girlfriend of the deceased Mr. Clark, who we're now being told wasn't. So what
doesn't
has,
mean she wasn't.
What
doesn't,
is the
even
statement
though we're told
of
that,
the EMT?
That doesn't mean she wasn't.
Huh?
Even though we're told that, we don't know what relationship between two people are. I mean,
we have no idea, if you will. But here's the situation. Everybody that I just named is going to be going up before the grand jury. And the way that the federal government, or as we like to say, the feds act, God help you if you get caught perjuring. And so I hope that folk just, you know, we even said that, of course, to our good friend Mr. Wilson. We just hope that everybody's got their testimony together. Now, Mr. Nelson well remembers a program about a month and a half ago where we asked what kind of preparation was the NAACP, specifically Urban League and others, giving to the witnesses so there wouldn't be this kind of confusion which killed the Michael Brown case in St. Louis. Absolutely annihilated that case. People coming in, and it was, you know, I know that Mr. Wilson was a little bit upset with the statement about from this commentator about, you know, conflicting statements and et cetera, but the fact of the matter is that's in essence what the county attorney told us in a very elaborate, quote-unquote, you know, press conference and public gathering, that the information coming from the community was so combobulated and et cetera, it just didn't make any sense, but everything that he was told, and primarily by the police officers and the EMTs, made all the sense in the world, and of course by the forensic experts.
And with that said, I'm sorry, I'm just giving you a second here. With that said, Mr. Edwards, we have a couple more callers, and I just want you to stay with us real quick.
Let's get them in. We still have, as I look at the clock, we have about 17 minutes. Go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Yeah. Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Would that be me or somebody else?
That is you, sir.
You, sir.
That is you.
Go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, I don't know if this is kind of a group of people holding here. No, I mean, well, you, of course, this thing, we would almost have to sit down and dissect this piece by piece because so many things come to mind. My first overriding thing would be to my elder here. I guess I would refer to you as such because I know you've seen a lot of stuff in your time. I want to ask you, is it too far-fetched for the governor, the county attorney, to be, by extension, involved in a police cover-up? And your time, have you seen such a thing?
You know, sir, I don't know who you are, but your voice sounds very distinct and confident. What I've been amazed in the last couple of days is I've seen press conferences and et cetera. Under the Minnesota Constitution, the entity that could turn this over, if you will, order a open investigation at the state level, there's nothing you can do with the feds, is the Minnesota Supreme Court. I would suggest to people that say that they are interested in reopening and et cetera, they need to take a look at the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, and they need to take a look at the relationship, sir, of the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota and the trial system and court system and jury system in the state of Minnesota, because the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota are the supervisors of both the grand juries and the petit juries. You asked an excellent question. And if you really wanted to create a political firestorm in this state, you should, under color law, petition the Minnesota Supreme Court to review and possibly reopen and appoint, which they can do. They have the constitutional authority to do that, appoint a special prosecutor and direct that special prosecutor to appoint a special grand jury. Hell of a question, sir, by you. Hell of a question.
And then, too, earlier somebody was saying something in this regard. I mean, of course, we've been wanting things to get out of the hands of the grand jury, which it did. So this is progress in that sense. Now, the bad thing is that County Attorney Freeman pretty much has taken the police story hook, line, and sinker, then put some BCA so-called evidence with it, and then he gave his narrative. But at least we got it out of the grand jury behind closed doors, and it's out in public. And then now we can dissect everything he had to say. And I would say, as you probably know, of course the police are going to be in lockstep, the men in blue. And if you got the population there, you're going to have all kinds of views and variations about what happened. That's what happened in Ferguson and around the country, because it's the public versus the police who are going to be uniformed in their narrative, because, you know, they're protecting each other, of course. So that's not surprising, okay? So what I'm saying – but that's what I'm saying. You can
just,
dissect
let me just indicate, sir, where I think that you're going in the direction. Again, I indicate the state Supreme Court can, in fact, take possession and supervisory authority, and they can compel county of Hennepin County to do whatever the Supreme Court says does, because the jury system in the state of Minnesota is under the direct supervision of the Supreme Court. You see, the newspapers knew and understand that they have experts and lawyers and et cetera. And if you've noticed, in our state, everybody kind of stayed away and only emphasized and highlighted what, unfortunately, these community representatives have said. Everybody who's a lawyer and who certainly understands constitutional law and et cetera, all were down there smiling to themselves. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I find it interesting that it's on a African-American program that a question is asked, and somebody says, well, you know, petition the state Supreme Court to take control and custody of the legal requirements to reopen a case and have them do that. Now, if the Supreme Court decides that it will not go to a grand jury, then that's the way it'll go. It's not going to happen over with the feds. It's not going to happen on the federal side. But if that's really what people really wanted and they're as knowledgeable as they pretend to be, that's what they would have done, sir. So I hope I've answered your question. I think we have some more callers, but I certainly appreciate your question.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, do we have another
question?
Who's that?
Well, this is M. I had a question.
This is M.
Yes, sir.
M.
Go right ahead, sir.
You know, and it just goes back to the point, you know, a couple of points, really. One, if this is under the auspices of ultimately the Supreme Court, I mean, is it under the auspices then of any county head attorney to just say we want to bypass the county, the grand jury process?
It is the prerogative of a local county attorney, unless challenged, which never happened. There was every opportunity. Folks were spending their time in Ramsey County District Court asking for some videos that we all know didn't make a difference. It is the prerogative of the citizens to as it said in the Constitution, both state and federal, to petition their government. And to your specific question, M., well-crafted, is that what all of these experts should have done that are out here leading our people is that they should have prepared their brief and asked to be heard before the state Supreme Court. And it goes back to your question that the property and the supervision of the court system / jury system in the state of Minnesota is under the direct supervision of the Supreme Court.
And again, to address the situation with the NAACP, is this organization not run by an attorney?
Yes, a professor
local
of Minneapolis
isn't run by an attorney. So
yes.
As far as
a legal
using
practitioner.
This,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so she would know this mechanism. But again, they was with great fanfare when the announcement was made that he's not going to the grand jury. It was seen as a great coup, okay?
Yes.
You've seen
absolutely
a great coup.
Excellent point.
So again, you know, be careful what you ask for. Okay, so you're giving this person the entree really to just sidestep a process and to just go right to go. And they jumped on it. You know, where there's a void there, a person will jump right in, and this is what the county attorney did. So
African American community is in an excellent position at this very hour to create a constitutional crisis if they know how to do what it is that you have to do. But, you know, that's not our job. You know what I mean? The youth and I.
But again,
how
can it be devoid of leadership when we have, okay, the Urban League director, he's an attorney, okay?
Yes, he is.
Director of Urban League attorney. Director of the leader of the Minneapolis NAACP is an attorney.
Right.
So, I mean, on the surface, the expertise should be there. The leadership should be there. But I just want to say I'm not seeing it. Maybe it is there. I mean, there's a lot of things.
Well, they're probably waiting
on
a grant. They're waiting on a grant, more than likely.
You know, and you're absolutely correct. And I don't think they want to do anything to aggravate a governor who happens to be a member of the same party as the county attorney. In a state that, you know, the Democrats want to see stay blue in the national election. See, this is much deeper. Maybe, M, this is much deeper than we give our leaders credit for not understanding. But you know, man, they have every opportunity to create a constitutional crisis and yet a constitutional challenge. But if they're up to it, only they and God know.
Well, again, I'm going to leave the program now. I've got to do a couple of other things, gentlemen. But I just want to say that, see, this is an opinion. Any process, being a grand jury process, being the county attorney making a decision, can be fine as long as it's just and as long as it addresses all the issues and as long as it's transparent. This is
Absolutely.
What we're asking for, whether it's a grand jury, whether it's the county attorney making the decision, whomever, as long as it brings out the evidence and all the information is brought to bear. So
right.
I guess that's my final statement on it for tonight,
Thank you.
Gentlemen.
All right. And I also, Mr. Allen, if we got another caller, we'll get to them in just a second. I would strongly suggest that people need to analyze the matter of Jerome C. Copeland and what was done to him by the county attorney and the state of Minnesota, technically, of a man who was a key witness in the death of Jamar Clark.
I would agree 100%.
Yes, yes. We got another caller, Mr. Allen. Let's listen to you.
No, we don't.
Lines
we don't.
Roll.
Not at this point. Not at this point. We do not have another caller.
Give that number out again,
hear.
Mr. Allen, very quickly. Just in
sure.
case maybe someone forgot it, hadn't heard it say it for a minute.
347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904.
All right.
So,
Mr. Allen, your observation from the right.
Okay. Well, you know, Mr. Edwards, I'm looking at this, and I just came across a story that was released about 6:45 tonight. Tony Boza, ex-chief.
Oh, ex-chief of the Minneapolis Police
Department.
Yeah, former
department
deputy whatever in New York City, right.
Yeah, 1980 through 1988 says that the officers
took credit for
should be
masterminding the assassination of Malcolm X. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. He said that the two officers should have been charged, but they were working in good faith. I don't know how to perceive that. I don't even understand that. So,
I don't either.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. That's what
yeah.
he's saying.
Okay.
And so I found that.
Was that an actual press release by my friend Tony Boza? That I mean, that
was
that
story.
It
could probably be in tomorrow morning Star Tribune.
Okay.
It's online right
and
now.
Boy, the Star Tribune has really been putting a hell of an effort into keeping our minds right and keeping us at peace with injustice. Notice what I said, at peace with injustice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Allen, additional thoughts, because I think we've had a very invigorating our program this evening. And again, I'm just wondering where the supporters of the leadership, well, maybe they're still coming down from the high of making a presentation over at the legislature and talking about the kind of dollars that they expect to get from the governor's $100 million proposal for the communities of color, the African Americans. I see that Senator Hayden has been put in charge by his legislative colleagues in the Senate of a special subcommittee. Have you picked up on it, Ms. Allen? I see you working on the computer right now as I'm talking to you from Studio B. That Senator Hayden will be holding hearings on who will be considered for whatever the amount of allocation will be from the $100 million.
You know, I've been following that pretty closely, and what I see is, you know, the usual suspects, Mr. Edwards. I'm very disenfranchised by that whole shenanigans that's going on in St. Paul right now.
Mm-hmm.
And certain people that should be at the table, yourself in particular, and a couple other folks, are not there. And so, again, we have a sanctioned and what I call, or allege, a misguided attempt to whittle out some pennies, because no one thinks about 2014 when a lot of veteran organizations and their big talk about homeless veterans, and Mark Dayton came up, Governor Dayton came up with this $100 million figure. But the problem
mm-hmm.
is they distributed $100 million, and not one African American, Native American agency got a penny.
That's
okay,
absolutely
and
correct.
Think,
and it was on this program at that time that we saw presented a proposal called the Benefit Bowl Proposed Budget. A 12-month budget was submitted by a number of organizations who were talking in terms of that amount, if you will. Those folks out there know who they are. And we still have that proposal, that budget in our files, if you will. In fact, we'll just stay away from giving all the names. It's kind of embarrassing, but they're back. They're back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they didn't get funded the last time. These are organizations in our community. In fact, even they, you know, asked for money for our community radio stations, as an example, WRNB and KMOJ and KFAI. And, I mean, these were far-reaching, if you will, stipends and et cetera, if you will. Minnesota State Baptist Convention, you remember what we talked about that. Their title was Together Together. And they actually had a budget for the period 2014-2017. And their proposed budget, again, this is the Minnesota State Baptist Convention, $5,059,000. So $5,059,000. And staff, if you will, they had compensation for staff in the period 2014-2015, $520,000. 2015-2017, $4,264,000. They had employee benefits, professional and contractual services, if you will, even supplies, you know what I mean, occupancy, if you will, travel, not a lot of travel, insurance, they were going to have insurance, and et cetera. I mean, these were proposals that my colleague, Mr. Allen, had just addressed, and we called them up on our computer from our well-secured computer network. Yeah, man, there was a lot of money being suggested and being proposed to the governor and the legislature, if you will. We had youth proposals, the whole thing. And my colleague is absolutely correct, and these documents are on file. We even had a nice package for the YWCA in St. Paul.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nice deal.
Before their director left and took early retirement. But anyways, yeah, so this is what's at play, and I know we're coming up on the end of the broadcast, and I guess all we can say, we'll be back with you next Wednesday, and the Jamar Clark situation is not going to go away. Mr. Allen,
no,
take us home.
Not anytime soon. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for calling. You're listening to the Ron and Don Show. We'll be back next Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. So tune in online at Blog Talk Radio. Listen to around the world. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you, sir, Mr. Allen.
Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.